Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 22 of the Free Cities Podcast. Today I'm in the process of packing my bags once again on the eve of our next Free Cities fact-finding trip abroad. I'll be travelling to Portugal tomorrow to attend LibertyCon Europe in Lisbon, and then we're off to Montenegro afterwards to visit the Free Society Project of Montelibro. Look out for those conversations in the future. And in the meantime, we are continuing our series from Poland with a discussion about free entrepreneurship and education with Mikołaj Pezarski. Now, Mikołaj is the former president of Koliba Association and the current president of the Instytut Misesa, which is Poland's Mises Institute. In this conversation, we discover Mikołaj's love for working with young people and his passion for teaching libertarian principles and the ideas of Austrian economics. We also talk about Polish history, the problems of democracy, personal responsibility, and parenting strategies, as well as a little anarcho-capitalism and technology thrown in for good measure. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and if you happen to see us at LibertyCon this weekend, don't be shy. Come and say hello. We love networking and making new connections in the wider community. But in the meantime, just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Mikołaj Pezarski. About what you're currently doing. I know that you're part of the Instytut Misesa, or Misesa, am I saying that right?
Misesa.
Okay, right. And I'd quite like you to explain in your own words how you've come to this point. Are you the president of the Instytut Misesa, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, so how about tracking back a little through time and tell us how you got to that point.
Sure. So in the past, when I was young, I was a crazy lefty, and to the point of not even stepping into McDonald's because my shoes would get dirty with a globalization. And I was like, I was really, really hardcore into this. But like two topics were always pretty important to me. One was the environmentalism and the other was the equality. Back then I understood it as, you know, in a more egalitarian concept of equality. And my brother, luckily, younger brother, he knew, like, he was very, very fascinated by the Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and he came to the works of Friedrich August von Hayek, and he introduced me to the Constitution of Liberty, and he posed a challenge with me. So if you are so smart, give it a try and try to refute it. And well, like, I was stunned that you can come to basically the same outcomes at a lower price to make it all simple and get away with the problem of this, you know, people, the managers, the bureaucrats getting in the way and clogging and bogging everything down that we experienced in the Polish history on so many occasions in the past. So that was like my entry drug, not your typical entry drug into the Austrian school, I believe. But then I got more and more radicalized, if I may say so.
Hold on a minute. Before you get radicalized, just a quick question about being a lefty.
Because I'm
when you're a lefty, as you put it back then, is the economy of much importance to you? Is thinking about those kind of things important or not?
No, I was young, much into the punk rock music scene here, so there were other important topics, if I may say so. But these two, like, I really, really cared about the problem that the capitalism, that I, as I understood it back then, is generating these external effects that are destroying the environment. I'm worried that if I were to live in this time, I would definitely be a part of Extinction Rebellion or something like this. So maybe I got lucky.
Well, or yeah, but maybe Hayek may have saved you even from Extinction Rebellion. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, how old were you when you first discovered these kind of ideas then?
I must have been 14, 15.
Really?
So it's...
Oh, really? So we're talking... And when you were young, what was your exposure to socialism, for example, in Poland?
Like the funny thing about the Polish history is that many people perceive it that the opposition that fought the communists was anti-socialistic, but it wasn't always true. Like a lot of members of the former opposition were fighting the communists for not being socialistic enough. They believed that they are, you know, somehow straying from the path. And like in Poland, these two, like anti-communism and anti-socialism, are not necessarily, or in the past, they were not necessarily mingled together. So you could be, and the current ruling party, the Law and Justice Party, is a good example of this, that you can be, at least in rhetorics, highly anti-communistic, but at the same time, very interventionist, or one could say even socialist kind of party. So back then, this link wasn't clear, and like everyone knew that the communism is bad, but at the same time, the socialist ideas were perceived by many, and myself not excluded, as noble.
Interesting. I think, well, my interpretation of what many people in my country who veer towards liking socialist ideas, I think possibly don't acknowledge the severity of communist ideas, actually. I think this is is that something, do you recognize that idea that I see on the right hand side of the spectrum, funnily enough, people would call out the far right as obviously not a good idea. But what I've noticed back home on the left, the left doesn't tend to call out the far left, or even necessarily to see it as a bad thing. Is that something that you recognize?
I mean, in the current generation, more like, because when I was young, this memory was still vivid. Like you could still get many meetings at school, for example, or at the university with the people who were directly involved with who fought the communists, and even some of them who lived under the Stalinist times in Poland, which was obviously the worst part of it. The whole movement that was very culturally significant and played a huge role in the current not so good government in getting into power was the movement to, for example, bring back the memory of an armed group called Cursed Soldiers, a group of people who, after the ending of the Second World War, did not lay their weapons and continued to oppose the communists, the Stalinists, living in the forest and taking it to a partisan opposition. And these people were completely smashed by the communists, and they were trying to basically erase them from history. And only recently, like in the times of my youth, these formative years, this memory was being brought back to school, to the institutions focused on history, like the National Remembrance Institute, stuff like this. So it was a big deal. But at the same time, I see now with the young people that we work with that this link was somehow somewhere broken. That they've lost this association, that they not only see the socialists, as I've said before, that the socialist ideas are noble, but also for the first time in my memory, at least, they are trying to nitpick good things about the communist rule in Poland. Like, for example, look how many flats were built, look how many industrial projects were realized, and they have to do it in a nitpicky way, because the economic history of Poland is pretty well documented. There is quite a lot of data, and it's very easy to empirically demonstrate all the inefficiencies of the socialism, but they still do it. And many young people are falling into this trap. And that's like, that's one of the main problems that we face now when we work with young people, either in high schools or with the younger grade students.
You say when you work with people, you're talking about the Institute?
Yes.
Let's get back to how you arrived at... So you're a lefty, your eyes are opened...
I mean, not necessarily open, but the high got me thinking, and there was this organization, because if you know what the Students for Liberty is, you can greatly imagine a similar organization that was running here in Poland for over 20 years now, called Koliber Association.
Okay.
Like in Poland, there was always this link between the more conservative way of thinking, like on a cultural level, not intellectual. I'd say it's more cultural thing, conservative and liberalism. It's even called, like in Poland, conservative liberalism, that hence Koliber. And my brother was a member of this. So I thought to myself, well, why not give it a try, come to one or two meetings, see what interesting things they have to say. And I stayed. First, I stayed as this like a free electron, just coming and going to the meetings. And then I gradually became more and more involved. And the pivotal moment was that a project that got started called Economic Lessons for the Youth. Like it was cooked up by my friends from Poznań, a Polish city near the border with Germany. Tomek Pourul, Agnieszka Białas, and Kasia Guziak, there are three names. People, they wanted to bring this basic principles of Austrian economy, entrepreneurship, into the schools, because we've all seen from our experiences that the school curriculum is very lacking in this regard. But they were young people, I was even younger, there was not so much experience. So they've reached out to the Mises Institute of Economic Education and asked my now colleagues to help them and guide them, help them prepare this curriculum. The result were the interconnected six lessons of basic economy, and we've started doing this. And I'm laughing to this day that for 2 years I was basically running a full teacher's job without salary. Because it was so inspiring, it was so much fun of going into the schools and talking about this stuff, and the results were great. Like, my favorite thing about this, like when we were talking about the free market and socialism, the way to how do you distribute goods and how do you approach this problem of what and in which quantity you want to produce. So they came up with a wonderful idea that they want to demonstrate it through a catalactic game. So we've brought sweets into the class. We divided it into two groups. One was like the free exchange group, and the other was centrally planned one. They wanted to, they had to elect either a committee, a monarch, whatever they wanted, but only this ruling body was allowed to distribute. And the others were free to change the different sweets, like, I don't know, mints, some jellies, whatever. We try to make sure to bring something that many people intentionally dislike to kind of incentivize the trades.
Right, licorice, you mean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, yes, I know, like it's okay, right. Something like this.
Yeah.
So, and then you just ask them questions. And it was so enlightening to see these people without any background in economics or anything like this, getting their brains worked up about this idea. And I believe this was like the first time that I really understood that this is something that I truly love doing. The Institute was generous enough in offering us training. Like, they invited us to their School of Economics, like a summer type program. And this was my first like a proper introduction to the Austrian school, because that's an Austrian bootcamp that the Institute runs to this day.
Before we go on, back to the sweets, I like that. But I didn't understand necessarily what the actual procedure was with the sweets. Like, for example, what were you asking them? What were they supposed to be doing with these sweets?
So first we divided the class into two groups.
Yeah.
And then we distributed sweets as unequally as possible, so that they are incentivized to exchange. And we told them, your only goal for this is to leave as satisfied as you want to get. So if you like mints, maybe you want 4 mints. If you are not hungry, you can try to exchange the sweets, I don't know, for a favor, or maybe for support with your homework or whatever. We didn't, you know, put any boundaries. But if you are in a centrally planned group, there is one caveat: the ruling body decides. And it can decide that it can take all your sweets, half, 3/4. And like my favorite times was like where when the ruling body decided that they want to take all. And then it got like it could get really, really hairy, like in just one instance, but it was so brilliant, the guy just refused to redistribute.
But like I would have assumed, you see, on such a small scale, the sort of, you know, the centrally planned group would have just divided the sweets up equally between everyone. Obviously, but some of them were sweets that people didn't like. Is that
they were different kinds.
Sure.
So you've had like at least 5-6 different kinds. And then you like the simplest thing that we've done after, you know, like this 2 or 3 runs of exchange were done, we asked them, raise your hand if you feel more satisfied than before we started doing this. Like 99% of the free exchange groups were always raising the hands. And like the other one, even if like half of them were feeling satisfied, it was always, you know, a smaller quantity. So then we've just like, we didn't want to even nudge them. Then it was just a question. Why do you think that is? How would the central committee approach the gathering of the information, for example, necessary to distribute it? Do you think that it would be possible to keep the same rate of satisfaction if we were to extend our play to the level of a whole year, whole school, city, country? And then you go with the, you know.
Did the centrally planned side pick a... How did they go about picking a leader, a sort of an institution or a state? How did they go about that?
Oh, that was another good thing that we've came to after it came to us with experience, because usually you see the people with this like characteristic traits that are making them this leader. So if someone was shouting, me, it's me, I was like, okay, you are the president, you get to decide. And it was also, you know, I was sure that a guy with personality like this will also be, you know, more prone. Yeah, exactly.
Well, it was. Is there empirical data to show that from your tests? So if you desire to be the leader, you're more likely to hoard the possessions yourself or the sweets yourself.
It was like the goal wasn't even for him to keep the sweets. It was more like to boss others around.
Right.
Like if he was, you know, had this strong extra vertical traits, like he was able to naturally hold this authority. Because if it was someone like, you know, more timid or quiet, it would be easy for the rest of the group to overrule him or even rebel. And if some of the groups even ask if they can rebel or hide the sweets, we were always encouraging this. Like you can hide the sweets. It's up to him to make you give it. And like the young people are so smart about this. Like if someone was hiding it, he was instantaneously talking to others, not doing this himself, talking to others. Look, he is hiding. He is taking this away from you. You will have less when I'm done. Do something about it. And they were coaxing them to, you know.
How did that particular character get on in the free market side when they did it on that side?
There was no leader. In free market, we first, like, we did it in iterations. So first we kind of divided them in groups, like the 4 or 5 people, and then to make them get the feeling of it. And then we allowed the whole section of the class to walk around and exchange and ask or even bid for suites, whatever they wanted to do. And we've understood that the less rules, the better the outcome on this side.
What I mean is the former leader from the centralized side,
yeah,
did he or she fare well on the free market side, or was he or she dissatisfied?
They didn't switch it.
Oh, they didn't switch?
They didn't switch it. It would take too long, sadly.
Oh, okay. That
you only get 45 minutes. So.
That would have been interesting to see. All right, then. This poses a question for me about democracy, then. What's your personal view on democracy?
I'm highly skeptical. I'm a non-voter on principle. Actually, I've only once participated in the elections, and it was like the local election, so maybe something that more close to your idea. And to be honest, I did it only to understand how it works, to see the technical side of the process. And I'd argue that the problem, and we've seen it in Poland, there is this inherent proneness of democracy to the threat of populism. And we, especially as the libertarians, we refuse it on principle. And we have no good tool to fight back with the populists, because the best thing that we could settle for is some mild deformed version of libertarianism or liberal ideas, and it would only be degenerating over time. Like, we, from the Polish perspective, we like to say that we've already had the best safeguard of liberty that we can realistically hope for, and that was the American Constitution, and look where this got us. There is like zero chance of something similar happen in Poland or in any other country that is part of the European Union. So sadly, I'm not a great fan. But I wouldn't also argue or wouldn't jump into the camp of people who are calling for, I don't know, using this shortcomings of democratic system to glorify or kind of seek excuses for the authoritarian side, particular kinds of people argue for the reestablishment of monarchy, for example, because we've also seen that for the same reason that we've observed in the classroom, it promotes the people with particular set of traits that result in a particular and very concrete degeneration of power and erosion of any kind of liberties, not only economic liberties, but also the social liberties, which in a country like Poland are maybe even more important to safeguard than the economic ones nowadays.
And particularly you're talking about monarchy there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of tend to agree with you on that, although the most compelling argument I've ever heard for monarchy was that at least with a monarch, the thinking is long term, which would be better than the democratic system, which is changing every 4 or 6 or 8 years or whatever. So policies never get a chance to sort of run free, you know.
I mean, on the other hand, is it really good that the oppressive and inherently bad public government is efficient or thinking long term? I mean, if it's thinking long term, is it thinking about the libertarian or liberal principles or illiberal ones? And I'd like my government to be as inefficient as humanly possible.
Well, I suppose that, all right, but in the case of a monarch, a monarch is thinking long term and therefore is thinking, okay, are my, you know, inverted commas, subjects still going to be happy in 50 years? If so, I should carry on with this particular policy. That would be my sort of devil's advocate argument for the monarchy. But you're right. But it also relies on a good monarch, obviously. It's great when you've got a nice person as a monarch, but when it changes.
Yeah. When was the last time we've seen one, right?
I mean, you could argue, I don't know. I think sometimes people, like in the UAE, for example, some of the royal families there seem to be very in favor. I don't know enough about it. I have brief travels to the Middle East, but correct, you know, you never know who's going to take control later. But so if you were to then start from a clean slate with a particular governance system, and that wasn't obviously democracy, as you've just alluded to, what would it be for you?
So I myself am an anarcho-capitalist, so I don't believe there is any kind of necessity of government involvement in production of any kind of goods. I don't believe even that the like international relations, the law, the police enforcement are necessarily public goods, and I believe that they don't require involvement of the government. We just didn't had the enough liberty to try alternatives to this. And the ones we've seen with the government's involvement fared very, very poorly. Like if we, for example, one of the most often cited argument in favor of the state is that it produces security. But if we look, for example, for things as mundane as the road system and the traffic laws, we see that with so many casualties, if this was run by a private company, we would have politicians all over the place calling for some special commission, audits, nationalization, imprisonment of the people responsible for this thousands and thousands of deaths. And the government is not even able to sort something as simple as the safe network of roads and enforce its own rules in a way that would limit the number of casualties. And if we go step higher, especially now talking in Poland, the situation with the war in Ukraine, we see that the governments were completely unable to not only fulfill the promise of peace. If we remember, the Ukraine got disarmed, gave up their nuclear arsenal, like in exchange for security guarantees, which were now completely thrown out of the window, and they are completely unable to provide this lasting security. Like in Polish case, for example, with only a week before the outbreak of the Russian invasion, we've heard the highest officials from the Ministry of Defense saying that it's a bluff, nothing will happen. The American security community is insane, they are pushing for the war, Putin is only bluffing. So how are we supposed to feel safe with people as incompetent in power producing this most vital goods? And how would it work in a society, in a stateless society? We cannot know because we didn't have this tried out. But we can expect that if this was as incompetent as our public run producers of security are, we could at least expect some kind of accountability.
What about, go on, then use the example of roads and road accidents, etc. How would the private sector be dealing with that in the anarcho-capitalist system?
There are so many ways, like for example the way we design roads. Like the problem of roads is that we can argue that we have oversupply of roads in comparison to other kinds of goods that the state produces, and if we do it, we over-incentivize the particular way of life that is centered around the ownership of a car, which is, not a especially European problem, but in the US, it's so obvious if you look at the history of the American roadway system, that it was basically a huge public investment project that was, you could even argue that it was kind of social engineering project aimed at making people live their lives completely dependent on their automobiles or cars, back then automobiles, and the public-owned road system. In Europe, obviously, it's less of a problem because our roadways were established before, but they are not safe. Like if you look, for example, for the way we manage the traffic flow, only recently we've begun introducing the cohesive way to manage the traffic flow in the city centers with the light system and all that. We can expect that the private system would be incentivized to look for similar or complementary solutions that would make it easier for people to move around the cities. And that's another problem with the way we design our cities, or so I believe, is that with the zoning laws. Like in Poland, the debate about how high we can build or how widespread should the cities get, it's one of the most heated political debates, and the government is completely involved in this. And if the zoning laws is forcing you to live like half an hour or an hour away from the place in which you are supposed to work, you are forced to, indirectly, but coerced to use a car and use this dangerous, inefficient road system to get to work and get a living. So that's
going back to what you said about roads in America. Wouldn't Henry Ford have been incentivized to fund roads in order to sell his cars, though, in the private sector?
Of course he would. The question is, could he ever amass the necessary resources? If we look for the price of the roads, that it turns out that this simple thing is one of the most expensive things that the government builds. And it's like, to be honest, it's crazy how inefficient it can get. Like in Poland, the amount of money spent on roads is completely mind-boggling, and they're always in a state of complete and utter disrepair. Like you cannot get from, I arrived here from Krakow, which lies in the southern part of Poland, and I took a train. Because if I were to drive from Krakow, which is the second largest city after Warsaw, half of the road is just like a two-strip road going through some small villages and fields without any kind of infrastructure. And only in the middle it was built, and only in recent years to the European standard that you can safely and swiftly travel. So and that's two biggest cities. So that tells you a lot of how well government is dealing with even the most basic problems as the roads. And I'm using this intentionally because there's this, we all know this joke, right? Without government, who would build the roads? I mean, show me a single country in which the people are actually, you know, content with the states of the roads that the government supplied.
I know what you mean. It is the most common rebuttal. Okay, so as an anarcho-capitalist then, what do you think about the notion of free cities, as in free jurisdictions founded upon property rights, for example? Do you think, like, pick holes in it for me. So where would you see the problems with the idea of the free cities model?
I mean, getting there from now would be, and I believe that's the universal problem that we have as the libertarians. It's not about the soundness and internal consistency of our ideas. The problem is, how do we get to them from this unsatisfactory today? And I believe this would be a great deal, because the whole discussion about cities, I believe, and that's why your mission is so admirable, was completely overtaken by the left. At least that's what we see here in Poland. Like everything that's been happening in recent years, whether it's on a smallest or the highest level, regarding to the governance of cities, was basically call for the more intervention and more tight control from the central government. And I believe there is this natural fear that people might feel when they are presented with this idea. Because correct me if I'm wrong, But this would also mean that they have to feel more responsible for this little part of the...
They would sign a contract. So they would have to have responsibility for reading the contract and sticking to the rules, But they would, there would be no coercion involved in signing that contract. And obviously in the future, the idea would be that you have a diversity of... And when we say free cities, we're talking about jurisdictions. So don't even necessarily think of it as a city, you know. Okay. But you would have the option to opt into the contract that you felt represented your own particular beliefs or wants or needs. But it would be, you would have to take responsibility for that act. There is no offsetting in the future your responsibility to somebody else. Correct. So, yeah, you think people would be scared of that?
I mean, to me, it sounds amazing. I mean, give me one and I sign it right away. But yeah, I mean, and I believe that the main problem might be this psychological cost, like this subjectively felt psychological cost of direct confrontation with responsibility. Because the whole point, and that's one thing that the state is actually very successful is, it's managed to convince people, or not even convince, it managed to make people feel good about their own complacency. And even if they are like on an intellectual level, they can perceive, for example, the cost of inflation, the alternative costs of I don't know, some government misuse, failed spending, failed projects, stuff like this. They feel very, not even secure, maybe. This would be...
Disempowered.
But not in a negative way, or so I believe. I believe that people, it's not a good feeling, but it's not bad either. You know, they don't feel this burden of responsibility. And I believe that's an important factor that we should address and we are not addressing enough as libertarians. Because when even the like, imagine this from this subjective point of view, the sole act of signing a contract, to many people, that's prohibitive of taking any action because of the anxiety that they feel or the fact that you have to go through this and we want to escape from this, the formalized legal language. And I believe this is like not economic, not theoretical objection, but purely subjective and psychological one that might be prohibitive to many people. And even when they sign it, like, we don't have this culture of safety nets established yet. Like, for example, if you look at the insuring companies, because you can insure yourself, right, for the opportunity of, I don't know, not being able to fulfill your obligation or, I don't know, declare the consumer bankruptcy. But people are the culture of using these institutions, it's not so widespread. Like, for example, to many people, most people, insuring companies are basically a scam. They consider them to be a scam. In many instances, they're right to think so. But I mean, what do we expect from a business so tightly linked to the government after all?
So that fear of personal responsibility then, that's kind of something I see in the memes of the younger generation as well. You only live once, YOLO, all this, that kind of, and it's obviously a left-leaning ideology. Is that, according to you at least, is that a symptom of the 21st century, or is that something that's the human beings have always been like that? This because I think currently there appears to be a small resurgence in the culture of personal responsibility. You could certainly the kind of younger men, for example, are starting to acknowledge that possibly it's something they didn't think about before. And I would imagine that's a response to the YOLO culture of no one cares. It's just like, do it now because you never know what's going to happen tomorrow kind of thing.
I mean, on the margin, of course, as a reaction to this widespread trend, but I'd be... Actually, I'm a young parent. I have two little kids back home. And that's the most scary thing about this all is that this whole generation that we see, a bit older kids, are so disempowered. You've used this word before, and here it would apply perfectly. They feel so disempowered. And it's not that they are... It's not that... It happened overnight. It was, if I were to guess, it was a result of two things. One of them, purely cultural, outside of the government or any kind of state control. And this would directly relate to the way that the current generation is being brought up. Like, I myself, I was born in the early 90s, and I might be the last generation that was actually free range kids. Like, I was able to make mistakes. I was able to take personal responsibility for my fault, playing with my brothers outside. I was free to explore the world outside of my parents' control. The current generation, like, and we see it in the data, there is a large drop, for example, of the time spent outside, playing outside. But it might not even be that bad, but we have this stark drop in the time or number of days spent meeting with their friends, exploring the world together. And I don't want to sound like some boomer generation or whatever, so I wouldn't blame it on technology or anything. But there is a problem with the way we approach parenting, and that's the consequence of this is that we are depriving the kids of their internal locus of control.
Okay, before we go on, then, why is that? I mean, what precedes this bad parenting? I mean, why are parents, you know, keeping their kids inside more, not, you know, like being overprotective? What, because it obviously originates with them in some shape or form.
I mean, I'd love to know the answer. But even with my wife, when we are looking and like trying to examine our own decisions, like a four-year-old kid 20, 30, 40 years ago, four-year-old was perfectly fine playing outside alone under supervised. My four-year-old, I mean, even if I want to let him play alone, a police would come and take him and you know.
I know, correct. But what about you personally? Because I'm the same. I have young children as well. And I know all this. And I can see, you know, a friend of mine has videos of them as old cine footage of them playing as kids in a playground. And we were watching it recently. You look at the playground there, it literally looks like a rubbish tip with nails sticking out and kids are falling and, you know, and I look at that and I think, yeah, and I remember doing stuff like this, getting conkers out of trees with blocks of, you know, with breeze blocks that landed on one of my friend's backs and in her, you know, and things. And even though I know all that stuff, I still feel nervous to allow my kids to do it. I do let them, but I have to force myself. Like, I have to force myself to live with the uncomfortable feeling that something bad could happen to them. So what changed? I'm not worried about the police telling me I'm being an irresponsible parent. It's a real feeling of anxiety that something bad's going to happen. So either my mum and dad didn't care about me, which I don't believe is true because I think they did, or something's changed and I now overly care about my own kids. So, you know, I could hypothesize that, for example, the media has done that to me. The media has reported consistently on scary things, and therefore my sort of subconscious thinks that the world is much more dangerous than it actually is. What do you think it is? Why am I a rational person? Why am I worried more about my children than my parents were worried about me, when obviously nothing's changed, or in fact, it's probably got better?
I mean, if I were to guess, like, there's this funny thing about the French Revolution, for example, that it didn't happen at the lowest point of the French society. It only happened when things started to get better. And maybe we're at this point where things are finally getting better to the point for the parents to try to make this revolution and take it in a really, really bad direction. Because in the past, like if I remember this, the unsupervised play was just as much a decision and as much necessity on the part of my parents. Like my dad was working long hours, my mom was busy with me and my two other brothers. There just wasn't enough resources. Now, with the unprecedented growth of the resources that we've seen in recent decades, we finally have resources to really, really take care and maybe overcare of our own kids. Like if I compare the amount of literature, for example, that I consume and my wife consumes about the way how you bring your kids, how you know on every imaginable topic, from you know, making
starting
above
with even names.
Exactly.
Yeah. It starts before they're born.
I mean, that's it's like it's unimaginable amount of knowledge that you can consume. Like my parents were fine with just one book and they only use it when something really bad happened.
Yes.
And I mean, I didn't turn out bad and no one.
What do they call that in psychology when you have so many choices that you make a bad choice, or so many so much information that you kind of you give up, you can't decide. There's a word for it anyway. It's a bit like that. The anxiety arises from knowing too much about what could go wrong, basically.
Yeah, and even, you know, like many things that were overlooked in the past, like now parents have resources, the time, like the most important resource, they have time to think about this and look into these problems. And like that's an open question, because we won't find the answer in data or in the literature yet. But for example, the rise of the mental illness problem, whether it truly is a rise of a mental illness or whether we are just getting better in discovering them and seeking help, and it was always there but either repressed or overlooked. Like this is a good
question. Well, I have an anecdotal story about that though, because where I live, the house in which I live, my neighbor on the other side of the valley, 100 years ago somebody wrote a book documenting their life in that exact house, okay? And she died in the 1990s, but before she died, she wrote a prologue to the book, you know, at what I've learned at aged 84. She wrote, you know, it was like life of a young girl in sort of rural Wales. And funny enough, in that addition to the book, she wrote about the fact that mental problems or sort of like, you know, those kind of problems did not exist in her time. So, and she was adamant that they actually didn't even exist. That the idea that you could have anxiety, for example, other than being scared of a bull in a field, you know, the idea of this kind of constant anxiety didn't exist. And because she had it to compare to the 21st century or the end of the 20th century. So that's my anecdotal evidence. I think I could agree with that. I think a lot of, and this goes back to what you were just saying, that with this new evidence that anxiety exists, you almost certainly end up with a lot more anxious people who start, you know, looking at themselves going, that's me, I'm anxious. Maybe confusing it with something else. Maybe it's to do with also the modern world, I mean, the world of, you know, technology and information is arguably much scarier than the world of simplicity where you didn't know as much. I don't know. I mean, what do you think?
I mean, technology, I mean, if I were to pick one thing, the social media definitely plays a way. And there's, I mean, there's not that much research that we've done on this, but I believe that the impact of the social media is crucial. And if there is something that truly changed in the way that the young people interact with the world, it must be Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, and Instagram culture. But if I were to also dug into this, there is another thing that changed, And this time it's related to our institutions. And that's the system of the public schools. Because the level of control, the tight control, the even police-like control that the schools, especially in the Western world, are holding over students' lives, are becoming truly scary. Like, to me, when I first arrived in the US, I was actually driving around with a Uber driver, and he told me that he's also working as a teacher. And we were having a great chat about gangs in his school. Like, I was like, are you are aware that you have gangs? Can't you do something about it? Oh no, they're going to threaten me or even do something worse. Okay, we don't have this in Europe yet. But schools in even in Poland are the sites of, if you look at the police data, for example, are the sites of the most frequent breaches of the law. Of course, a chief part of it comes from non-violent offenses that should never be offenses in the first place, so drug-related things, so some stuff like this. But also, we have some pretty nasty stuff going on in schools, especially in the US. And I'm not talking about the school shootings, but the muggings, the bullying, and all this stuff, which is definitely affecting the quality of life. And here, you don't have escape as a young person, because it's a forced integration. You are forced, especially in countries with strict zoning laws that are forcing you to choose a school based on the quality of your parents' home. This is a big problem, because you can't escape from this toxic environment in which you are forced to rot and waste the most creative, most productive years of your life. Luckily, in Poland, it's not that bad. Even this terrible government of law and justice introduced some bills liberalizing access to homeschooling. So you have, in Poland at least, you have alternatives and you can escape. We also don't have a strict zoning laws, so you can freely change schools.
Do you have private education here?
We do, but it's like it's very minor, and it's like the quality of it is very low, because many people consider it to be pay for your diploma, a kind of thing. So the best schools in the country are almost strictly public, but that's also because of the fact that in Poland we basically have the kind of Milton Friedmanish kind of education bond, just without the real bond, because the money is following the student and he is free to change schools. So basically even the public schools are competing for the best and brightest students here, at least to some degree. That's the one redeeming quality. But even with this in place, like we see, because we work with these young people, we see that so many of them are reporting and telling them that the school is the worst thing that happened in their life. It's ruining their lives. And like, who can they talk about this? Like, even if they call sick or try to skip school, if you go below 50% of attendance, you will be forced to repeat the year. Yeah. So the cycle
is interesting. I've just been through this whole process with my wife back in the UK, because we've got a daughter who's just about to enter upper school. And we homeschooled for a year, and it was great. But I think, unfortunately, my wife doesn't want to do it. So we have to put our kids into a school. And the local state school, we have a similar system. Yeah, we have one school they have to send them, and it has an incredibly bad reputation. So we decided, okay, we don't want to do that. We want to look elsewhere. And we ended up looking at some private schools in the vicinity. And they actually ended up being unaffordable, unfortunately. But my takeaway from those schools was that, and we both agreed this, that those private schools were essentially reminding us of the schools we went to when we were kids. That's all it was. It wasn't even an academic thing. And if you looked at the academic results, you didn't necessarily get incredible academic results just by going to a private school. But what you did get were things like people still aspired to success. Whereas at a lot of state schools, you find now that kind of kids don't want to admit they're aspiring to be successful. You know what I mean? It's a big thing, right? But at private school, they're still teaching that. They're also teaching manners, for example, which, you know, the me of 40 years ago would have laughed at me now. But I've become that person. You know, manners maketh man. I now know this. It is true. And teaching your kids, like, for example, one school we went to, you know, it was like you walk into the classroom and everyone stands up because you're an adult. And people look you in the eye and say hello and, you know, and respond to you. And I kind of, after visiting a few of these schools, I kind of understood what was going on. Is what they were offering was actually culture, not necessarily academic success. Obviously, I think they probably go hand in hand. But yeah, it's a really fascinating because, yeah, I mean, it's another example of inefficiencies in the current system. So your particular children, then, if you don't mind me asking, how young are they? Are you talking very, very young?
4 and 2.
Oh, okay.
So
are you imagining that they will be schooled or homeschooled or something?
On the first level, definitely homeschooled. And then we'll see. Like we live in Krakow. We have plenty of very good public, sadly, but good schools. So there's this to consider. But we want to at least try and see how it works with homeschooling in this framework. And maybe there was a glimmer of hope recently in Poland, if it won't get destroyed by the government, because the largest school in Poland actually is a private one, and it's completely digital. It's called a school in the cloud. It's registered here in Warsaw, but it has several thousand of students, and it was started just recently. I believe it's less than 2 or maybe 3 years. It was started out of this necessity to give students some place to escape from this oppressive system that they found themselves stuck. So there are three groups of students who go to this place. First are students who are in some way sick, to the point of it being tough for them to attend the regular classes. The others one over like this high achievers who would be hard for them to balance their hobbies or even professional career in many instances with the regular school system, and they have many different passions. You get professional computer game players, esport players, and you get people who play tennis or football or stuff like this. Also young people who are pursuing academic career. And the third group are just people who are looking for this escape from the either toxic or oppressive or highly unsatisfactory environment. And so far, looking at the stories of the people enrolled there, I mean, that's how all schools should be run in this country. Like, these kids are genuinely happy. They are so eager to talk about this experience and the difference that they feel after enrollment and the way that how crushed they felt in a state-run public school. Obviously, because it's private-run, the teachers are selected because of the scale and amount of students they can afford truly best ones. The people behind it are young professionals with the background in IT, so they have like very good systems set up in place. And so far, it's been working amazingly. And of course, the government now tried to shut them down. Because I told you, we have this education bond similar to the Milton Friedman ideas. And the way that the city of Warsaw, kind of looking at their balance sheet, looked, because it's paid by the local government, they looked at now they are paying, transferring this money from the city coffers to the several thousand of students living all over the country. And they went to the central government, and instead of, you know, changing this one line of the law so that, you know, the money can go from the residence place of the student, because it would be that simple if that's the only problem that they want to avoid, they've started to call in the media about the educational mafia.
But hold a minute, what is the argument against this type of schooling? Like what?
It's education mafia that is draining the precious coffers of the city of Warsaw.
Oh, right.
And the students are not getting the proper education.
Yeah, but they can't prove that. And I know, I mean, when we looked into homeschooling, there is a similar thing in the UK, or, you know, it's online, so it could be from anywhere. It used to be called Galileo. I think it's called something else now. And we have a couple of friends whose kids do it. And they don't want to go to school. They love it, and they're very specialized in what they're doing. Plus, the teachers are like super high value, you know. Especially if you're into coding and things like that. Like if you want to learn coding when you're 12, at school, you're probably talking to a teacher that knows far less than you do about computers. Whereas at these online schools, you actually get people who code for a living teaching and stuff. You know, and it's quite phenomenal. But okay, so what I mean, how far have they got in shutting down this online?
Oh, the school has been putting a superb fight. Like they've been very polite about this. They invited them to make control, showed them all the, you know, the way that they host exams. Like one of the arguments, because it's always an argument that the homeschooled kids or the kids in this kind of school won't learn to function in a proper society. So they've showed them the way that they organize the trips, the integration, the gatherings. And it's like, it's amazingly high level of professionalism on their part. And that way they were able to push back. And right now they are stuck. And it probably will last for a long, long time in the never ending cycle of controls, which obviously they will always stellarly pass because they are outperforming even the best public schools in the country right now.
But they could presumably host their software and their servers in another country. Because
the problem, you have to be like you still, even in a private, you know, arrangement, you still have to be registered under the, you know, the state program, because they need to. Like even homeschooled or in a private school, you are required to pass the state mandated exams.
Is that right?
In Poland, at least.
Ah, so even homeschooled kids.
Yes, you have to, like, after every level, you have to, like, after every year, you have to pass exam that checks if you are, you know, on track with your curriculum required material. And at the end, you have this, like, the gated kind of exams that are then potentially used to sort you into the next level of the education. They have to do it as well.
It's the mafia tactics. It's really quite astonishing when you think about it, that even the freedom to... Because the point of homeschooling for me is to allow your kid to specialize at a young age. That's what we discovered. We had a year of traveling in Central America with our children. And apart from maths and English, which I did with them and Liz as well, we let them do whatever they wanted, and they ended up doing certain things and certainly ended up not doing other things. With this system, you really have to stick to the curriculum of the state. Is that right? You can't, you know, or is it, or is this the curriculum pretty easy anyway?
It is, and it's like you can go over it. Like there's nothing limiting you, you know, expanding over. Like that was the problem that we've met at the Institute, because we've managed to write a textbook for the subject called Basics of Entrepreneurship that was introduced to schools, and it's government approved. It's one of the only six textbooks in the country that can be used to teach this subject. For some reason, the government wants to turn every student into an accountant. So, of course, we had to put this part of the knowledge in there, but nothing prohibited us from putting some more interesting and engaging stuff. And that's like the teacher can do the boring accounting stuff on one or two or three lessons and do the rest or reuse the materials, because like the whole point is for the teacher to do as little work as humanly possible, use our resources and focus on the more engaging stuff.
Is it Austrian Economics 101 or something like that? Like, is it, or is it more so?
We don't call it that for the obvious reasons, but it is.
What do you call it then? Just economics?
It's called the free entrepreneurship. Wolna przedsiębiorczość in Polish. So free entrepreneurship, it's the title of the book. And it's authored by the founder of the Institute, Mateusz Machaj.
What do they teach as economics 101 then?
Now we are facing another, yet because in Poland, for some reason, every government, the first thing they want to change is the curriculum, because gives you most power over young people. And now it will be literally nothing, like to the point of even inflation being removed from the basic, like the whole definition concept of inflation being removed from the basic curriculum of the lessons about the business and entrepreneurship in school.
But is there an economics, you know, like we had a certain level from 16 onwards, we had a subject which was economics,
it's now it's called a basic introduction to entrepreneurship, and after the curriculum change it will be called like the business and management. So they like
is practical rather than theoretical.
I mean, practical makes it almost sounds attractive, which it's the last thing it is. So
What is there any economic theory in it at all?
Very little. Like in the introduction, this one that we've written the textbook for, there was a place for economic theory, and we did it. Like there was quite a lot about the banking system, for example. Like I mean, for some reason, students in Poland were going in really deep into the investment banking, for example, which is a complete US phenomenon. And completely useless to the Polish student, but we've had this. And now they want to go in a complete other way, and they are not making them into accountants anymore. They will make them into HR specialists.
Oh. That's a result of the political stance of the ruling party, is that right?
I believe it's simple than that. It's just that there is always this one or two reformers who have their idea about how this whole thing should be run for every student in the country, and now they are in power to push this.
Who cares that much about not telling you about inflation, though?
This one obviously.
That does seem bizarre. I mean, not that I learned a huge amount doing the equivalent A level, which is called advanced level, which is the sort of highest thing you can do when you're 16 to 18. I did economics, and no one was told anything about Austrian economics.
Oh, but we're getting Latin back. Like every student in Poland will speak Latin in a few years. So.
Okay. We never actually finished our original conversation how you ended up at the Institute. There must be a little bit to fill in there. I'm cognizant of the time here, but we've been talking for a while already. Can you fill in the blanks?
Sure. So we were doing this economic lessons for the youth. I was at Koliber back then, and the Institute was basically mentoring us and teaching us as a tutors, as a volunteers to make the job much better. And then I found out about the Atlas Network, and I've started doing their leadership trainings. And I believe that I have some pretty good ideas about how to run this Koliber thing and make it, you know, more successful. So first I became the president of the chapter in Krakow. Then I've run for the president of the whole countrywide association. I won. And after a year the term was 1 year as a president, I was stepping down, and the folks at the institute already knew me well, and they've reached out to me and said, "Hey, Mikołaj, maybe you would like to come and help us grow the institute now, because at Caliber we've had really, really good results. Like we've had a very solid team back then. Caliber was just in Poland over 800 people. At the time, we were doing this economic lessons all over the country.
Was that also just libertarianism, though, or was that
it's
Austrian?
It was this six lessons, the economic lessons for the youth. This was basically Austrian economics.
I thought that was coming out of the institute, not Caliber. Caliber is the student.
Yes,
Liberty. Yes, Students for Liberty organization.
Caliber. It was run in cooperation between the institute and the Caliber.
Right.
So Caliber started this. Institute was teaching the people, like, basically the institute was brains. The Caliber was the muscle that will go into school and turn this project into reality. And then when my term at Caliber came to a close, I was invited by the institute team to join them as a president of the board. And it's been 5 years now. And also, like, if you look at the numbers, for example, I like to think about the numbers, like we've been growing at a rate of over 35% a year in terms of revenue at the institute for the past.
So you're at the center of what you do is the educational side of it. And I mean you personally, not necessarily the institute. Is that what gets you up in the morning?
Yeah, definitely. Yes. It's like that's why the institute was so attractive to me. Like the whole mission is to promote the Austrian School of Economics, but also teach the next generation of economists in Poland. And it was always my dream to share the knowledge that I kind of find in books and all around, and this was the way for me to fulfill it. So
do you have much curriculum on governance policies or governance methods? Is that part of the curriculum or part of what you teach?
No,
it's just economics.
Like, yes, we focus on economic theory, also political philosophy of libertarianism, obviously, but we can't do it at school. We are not policy-oriented institutions, so we're only seldom doing stuff like this.
But presumably you teach the efficacy of devolving power, for example.
Yes.
This kind of stuff.
This is correct, and especially outside of the school, because one of the things we do within the formal state-run system, like the textbook that we have, the economic lessons program that I've mentioned, and the others we do outside. Like we have this School of Economics that I'm the alumni of, which is like the flagship project of the institute. We've also started last year basically responding to the market needs, the School of Political Philosophy, which is more focused on the libertarian ideas. So we have...
Did you get to slip in any of the devolution of the state ideas into the sort of state-run education system?
Like, I mean,
presumably,
for example, when they Google us, or one of the things we do, we run the largest open database of articles on economics and political philosophy. And like we see it very often that they are reaching to us because they are writing an essay, or even later their dissertation or something like this, we see it coming up. And so it's more like not an active process on our part, and that's by design. It's more kind of an inspiration or osmotic kind of way to basically expose these people to this kind of ideas. Because if we weren't present, they would never even learn about their existence. Because, I mean, F.A. Hayek might be mentioned somewhere in the curriculum, but mostly because he met with the late Pope John Paul II, and that would be it. Mises, despite his connection to the former Polish city of Lwów, is completely omitted. Surprisingly, Karl Menger, the founder of the Austrian school, who was born in a Polish city of Neusiedl, Nowy Sącz, is also completely unknown. And like 2 years... was it 2 years or 1 year ago, we've had the 150th anniversary of the publication of the Principles of Economics. And we wanted to remind the people in his hometown about this remarkable person. And he was completely unknown, but we were successful. There is now a roundabout in the city center named after Karl Menger. So this
was... Do you feel that, or do you get a sense that there's a resurgence of Austrian economic ideas currently happening? Or, is that a real thing, according to you?
Definitely.
And talk about, if you know about the wider world as well.
Then... Oh, yes. Actually, only recently, I believe it was published last week. There was a chapter in a book written by my colleagues Mateusz Machaj and Krzysztof Turowski about the state of the Austrian school in Europe. And if just looking at the names, the whole idea was to make it as narrow as possible. So exclude libertarians, exclude people who are fellow travelers, just focus on economists who are active in the academia, who are self-describing as the Austrian economists. Like, the growth is amazing. And we see it in Poland, like when the institute began 20 years ago, my older friends were responding to the lack of academic texts available in Polish. Most of the work out of the institute for the first few years was basically a translation office. They were translating from German, French, English, of course, books and the articles. Now we have Austrian, in the University of Wrocław, where we are based, there is a whole cathedra of economics, which is basically run by the Austrians. We have one rector of the university in Białystok, Robert Ciborowski, who is a member of our scientific committee. So basically the head of the whole university is an open libertarian, open Austrian. It's an important university in Poland, not some small one. And many other people cropping up in places. The Prague that we've mentioned before, like, what you see there, what Joseph Schima, our good friend, did there with his several institute, this is another like amazing demonstration of how vibrant the community of the Austrian scholars had become. And in other places, just to mention Guido Hulsmann or Jesús Huerta de Soto in Madrid, we see that these people who in the past were just a single lone scholars were highly successful in gathering around them next generations of the followers who are very original thinkers and very productive ones. We see them not only publishing in the best and highest graded academic journals, but we also see them very actively engaging in advocacy, or advocacy is a bad word here.
Do they end up in the political sphere, though? Or are we back to the Swedes problem that the wrong people end up in power?
I mean, I was talking strictly about the academics.
But, okay, yeah,
okay, but if you want practical, in Poland we have at least one openly libertarian politician. He's my good friend and colleague, and also one of the former presidents of Koliber Association, Jakub Kulesza. He was on many occasions quoting Ludwig von Mises in the same during the most important parts of the proceedings. And there are many more who are influenced, like, and in many different parties, even in Law and Justice, which is hostile, strategically hostile to market ideas. You would find people who are well-read in the Austrian tradition, and they are very open about it. Like, just to name one, the current Minister of Higher Education and... I lost the translation into English, the name of the office. But anyway, Minister for the Education, in his doctoral thesis, he was quoting Austrians. Hmm. So we have a guy like this calling the shots. Of course, he's not for free markets and he's not putting these ideas into practice. But this is to approach someone and call the name von Mises, Hayek, and not expect these people to not stare at you blankly, but understand what you are talking about. This is a real and visible change.
I always wonder how how a politician would advocate for basically smaller government unless it got them more votes. You can see the predicament here. What do you think? Are you positive about the future of freedom, ideas of freedom, ideas of free markets, of Austrian economics? How do they become something that that benefit the majority?
Oh yes, of course. If I were pessimistic about it, I wouldn't be wasting my time in this field of work.
give me some pragmatic optimism about that.
The problem with pragmatic, at least here in Poland, is that many people are so fixated over politics, and I've completely gave up hope of achieving any kind of success in the field of politics. I don't think that's the way. But at the same time, I am so convinced, looking at this and analyzing, for example, the current inflation crisis from the point of the Austrian school, that it has to crumble under its own weight at some point. And I'm in the Rothbard camp on this, that the only thing that is preventing us from reaching this anarcho-capitalistic state of affairs is the mass act of will. And that's it. There is no internal contradictions or any internal or fixed in the human nature things that would prevent it from happening. The only thing that we need to achieve is this, calling it more in a more technical language, the baseline adoption rate for these ideas. And it's been happening on a so surprising such a surprising way that it exceeded our all expectations. Like when I was joining Koliber, it was like maybe 10 years ago, no more, there were like 5 of us meeting in some underground pub. There were no conferences, no nothing. And in just a day from now, we are going to meet in the hottest venue in Warsaw with over 400 people, speakers from the whole Europe and some other parts of the world. Like, even in my wildest dreams 10 years ago, I wouldn't think about this. And it's not the only event like this happening this year, just in Poland, mostly in Polish, mostly targeting the Polish audience. And there are other, like, even more unlikely places that we've seen even greater successes, like, for example, Georgia or Ukraine that I've mentioned. Like, people who are directly confronted with the threat of losing their freedom and the Russian authoritarianism, they've natural response is looking solution and salvation in the ideas of freedom, like the Georgian Students for Liberty. Like, they've been gathering like 800-900 people speaking Georgian on their conferences. This is completely insane, and even more impressive if you consider the resources that they have access to. Because like in Poland, we're good at fighting over our weight category, if I can say it in terms of budget. Like for example, the Institute, which is probably the second or third largest free market think tank in Poland, has like $300 annual budget, which is like nothing. and we are still, able to regularly do countrywide projects. They have even less, and still the outreach is amazing. And these people, and this is one crucial thing that changed, they are staying within the movement. Because in my time, I've seen so many friends and people come and go. They were like, this was a phase, this was a year or half a year of their life, and then they went and they've done something and they forgot. And now we see people who are staying within the movement, like moving from the supporter to the volunteer, playing some more active role for a year or two, and then maybe starting earning money or starting their families and giving back, coming back as a donors, as members of the board, for example, as aspiring scientists, writing and engaging in this exchange of ideas. So finally, we've reached this point, at least here in Poland, of a truly emerging, specializing community. And like when I started, like I would never dream about this.
Do you know why that is? Why people are staying? Why it's more sticky now? Is that anything to do with the macro environment, economic environment?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, but there's a trade-off to that. I mean, until Law and Justice put a stop on this, Poland was growing at an average rate of 4.5% of GDP per year. So we've had like enormous growth in real wages since I was beginning my studies. But there's a trade-off to this. Like, most of the libertarian organizations are still based on volunteer work. So how do you compete for volunteer hours if the entry-level job pays you 5k zlotys? So that's, you know.
Just quickly before we stop, because we probably should. You mentioned the inflation crisis and how that if it collapsed under the weight of its own pressure, if the ideas were enforced, were in existence, then there might be a resurgence of Austrian thought in fixing it at the end. How do you stop populism jumping in its place at that point? How do you stop if the inflation crisis runs wild? How do you stop people looking back at the state and saying, give me your strongest man to solve this problem?
It will be a short-term solution. Like, we as libertarians will never have a good answer to this problem, because we can't outbid the populist. I mean, the truth is not the bestseller, especially in the age of social media. But the good thing is that, and I was very skeptical about it. Look what happened to the modern monetary theory, for example. I was so sure that they are on a track to overtaking academia and making a true breakthrough. And now they are completely compromised. Like, even the most ardent supporters are, having to backtrack from support to this heinous idea that the state can basically print unlimited amount of money. So the same, I believe, we'll see in relation to the central bank run system of the fiat that we see all over the world. Because now, finally, people really got educated, and we see it. I told you, we run one of the largest databases of articles about the economics and inflation, among other things. And we see the level of engagement and self-education that people without, any organized funnel leading them to this point are doing organic searches, looking for this information. And from this, we're halfway done. The only thing that we need is this final push. And it might not come to that within our lifetime. I mean, I knew when I was starting this job that I'm in for a marathon, not sprint. So I don't have high expectations to see this in a year or two or three, but I'm very optimistic about the future.
How does the Polish Central Bank compare to the Federal Reserve or European Central Bank in the amount of liquidity that they're pumping into the system then? Do you know?
Oh, they basically mirrored the decisions that the Fed made during COVID. There was, and they've made it even worse because it was done outside of the official budget sheets through the, if we were not part of the European Union, we wouldn't even know how much money they've pumped into the economy. So only thanks to the European Union more tight reporting structure, we know that it was over 30 billions of zlotys that were introduced into economy, which is like almost one third of the official annual budget. And the problem with the Polish Central Bank is not even the way they approach QT, because in this they were basically mirroring the European and Fed central banks, but the way they communicate about this. Like, for example, in the middle of pandemics, they were promising that they won't, under no circumstance, they won't raise the interest rates. And what do people do? They rushed in for the cheapest credit within our lifetime. And now we've seen the biggest and longest hike within the generation. So many people are left with this problem. And the bank now, due to political reasons, because even their own projections would make them continue the hike, but for the political reasons before the upcoming elections, they've stopped the hike. So after the elections, they probably will see even sharper growth.
How do they report inflation? How do they come up with their inflation numbers? The same way that yeah, you know, basket of goods. And what do they say it's running at here in Poland?
Most recent it's 18.4.
18.
18, which is probably due to the way they construct the baskets. It's probably to your average, you know, most typical household. It's larger, so it's a bit.
Wow. Yeah. That's a disaster. Absolute disaster. And you have a prediction about the next 5 years with regards to this?
Actually, at the Institute, we are more optimistic than even the central bank itself, because they've made, when they were forced to tighten the monetary policy, didn't have the way to maneuver. So they've made a very, very fast tightening, and basically demand for new credit completely halted in Poland. So we even observe the M1 decreasing in Poland right now. And we at the Institute believe that the inflation might start to drop even sooner than the central bank own predictions expect, unless due to the upcoming elections, they will do something like the Fed did recently, which is, you know, outside of the economic reasoning, introducing political reasoning, the more likely scenario.
Yes, a shit show, I think, is one way of describing it. Well, Mikołaj, thank you for talking. Before we finish, I have one last question for you. It's a tradition on this podcast. I want you to imagine a 12-month sabbatical. During this, your life's paid for. You don't have to worry about money. Some libertarian benefactor has granted you unlimited resources. What would you do in your year?
Take my wife, take my kids, rent a van, and travel around the US.
Good answer. I've almost done something similar. We travel around the US, but we didn't have a van. It's phenomenal. I love the US. Are you a fan of the?
Yes, I mean the freedom of the open nature that you have there, it's second to none. The grandeur of it all is like it's incomparable to anything we have here in Europe. So that's something that I would love to show her and my kids.
Great answer. I know what you mean. I think a lot of Americans don't realize how lucky they are to have bona fide wilderness on their doorstep. In most states, you can literally take off into an area of proper wilderness, you know. Well, thank you, Mikołaj. It was great talking to you. Really interesting conversation. And I look forward to your talk at... are you doing a talk at...
Let's keep it a secret for now.
Oh, well, that's right. I know what you're doing. Absolutely. Well, I'll look forward to seeing you on and off over the next few days. But thanks for coming in. Thanks.
Thank you so much.